Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Skylar Jeremias. With one adalimumab biosimilar and three infliximab biosimilars on the market, and over 10 more biosimilars for rheumatoid arthritis coming down the pipeline, rheumatologists are about to have more treatment choices for their patients than ever before. 2023 marks the U.S. introductions of biosimilars referencing Humira, also known as adalimumab, and Stelara, also known as ustekinumab, with an abundance of choice comes storage, education, and payer challenges. What can practices do to prepare? How can they boost uptake of these products? And how can we ensure that the lower-than-anticipated uptake of infliximab biosimilars is not repeated? Today, I'm speaking with Robert Zutaut, clinical specialist with McKesson Provider Solutions, about the influx of these RA biosimilars and actions that clinicians can take to prepare for the large number of products expected to hit the market in the next couple years. Prior to his work with McKesson, he served as the Director of Pharmaceutical Services at Raleigh Regional Cancer Center in Beckley, West Virginia. He obtained a bachelor's degree of pharmacy from West Virginia University and has been analyzing RA biosimilar trends and the ever-changing market. He's also been keeping an eye on the development for prognostic biomarker tests for the RA space. Welcome, Robert. To start off, how do you think the 2023 introduction of up to 10 adalimumab biosimilars for the treatment of RA will impact payers?
Hopefully, it'll have the same impact that the other biosimilars have had in the past. And of course, you know, that it will drive down costs for the payers and the patients. It'll be interesting for me to see how this will play out in the pharmacy benefit environment, because we've seen it in buy and bill, but not necessarily in the pharmacy benefit, and how the payers will react with their preferreds in this space. We also have an added wrinkle of at least a couple of these products having interchangeability approval, which we haven't seen in the past with the previous biosimilars.
How do you think costs will be impacted for both patients and practices as a result of the market introductions of so many RA biosimilars in such a short period of time?
Well, Skylar, I doubt if there will be much of an impact in the beginning. Currently, Amgen is in this 180-day exclusivity period, so I don't expect to see a great decrease in cost under those circumstances. But as more manufacturers come into the space, you know, by mid-summer, it's really going to depend on how competitive those manufacturers are and how aggressive they will want to be at gaining market share. With so many of these products entering the market at the same time, it's probably going to be a bit chaotic as each company is going to try to plant their flag, so to speak, with these payers and providers. So in the end, I believe the cost will come down, but it might be like a game of poker with no manufacturer wanting to go all in early by lowering their price quickly to gain what would be brief market share.
Now, savings related to adalimumab biosimilar competition are expected to be substantial, but how long will it be before we see the true extent?
I can only speak to what I've seen in the oncology space, and then obviously that space with multi-specialty where infliximab has been used. With the oncology biosimilars, after about 3.5 years, we're now starting to see a leveling off of price. And we're beginning to see price increases and lower rebate incentives as these manufacturers try to reestablish a higher ASP. The infliximab space, it was a little different because Janssen really worked to stay competitive over many years, and they forced their competition to continue to lower their price and offer rebates. So once again, it just depends on how aggressive these various manufacturers are going to be in determining what that pricing is going to look like.
What role can pharmacists play in encouraging the adoption of RA biosimilars, and how can health systems work with them to improve patient confidence in these products?
The role played by the pharmacists, I think, could be huge in this space. the last two plus, last 20 plus years, we've really seen the role of pharmacists become very integral as a part of the healthcare team. And this space is no different, especially since this is going to be in the pharmacy benefit consumer space. The pharmacist could very well be the last health provider contact that the patient will see prior to actually utilizing the product. So health systems can leverage the knowledge of pharmacists and allow them to have those conversations that will assure these patients and will help to ensure that they have a positive experience as a biosimilar is dispensed. You know, one of the scenarios that I can visualize is a patient coming to a pharmacy to pick up his or her Humira prescription that they've gotten for years. And with the launch of the biosimilars, their insurance companies decided that the patient's preferred product is no longer going to be that reference or brand. So rather than add to the anxiety of the patient by emphasizing that they're getting something not quite the same as Humira, the pharmacist has that opportunity to explain that not only are they getting a product highly similar to what they've had in the past, but they're also receiving a product that's just as clinically safe and efficacious, but hopefully will be also less expensive. So, you know, that pharmacist could be the biggest differentiator for treatment failure versus treatment success, and also could eliminate, you know, that waste that would come about if the patient would not do well.
So far, rheumatologists have not been very receptive to previous RA biosimilars. For example, infliximab biosimilar uptake was lower than anticipated. Cardinal Health's report also found that most rheumatologists only want to prescribe adalimumab biosimilars with interchangeability designations, despite the label not indicating that a biosimilar with that designation is better than another. Why are rheumatologists taking so long to come around to biosimilars for RA, despite the promised savings for patients?
I think rheumatologists are in a little bit of a different spot. They're faced with the task of using a biosimilar and relying on what I would call very subjective responses from patients to determine their effectiveness. You know, they'll ask a patient if their range of motion has improved or has it declined. They might also ask what their pain level is. Both of these questions are really hard to get any kind of quantitative information around. So what happens here is this can result in what we call the nocebo effect. And this is a psychological response to a change in treatment management that results in a perceived, and I use that word, you know, with accent, perceived worsening of symptoms related to the patient's disease. He or she got what was described as something that was slightly different than the brand product that he or she had been receiving. And so now they're feeling worse when in reality, nothing's physically changed. So because of the potential risk, I think that's why uptake has been slow in this group, and I get it. Oncologists are in a little different place because they can use scans and other tests to determine that their biosimilar is working. Whereas with this group, like I said, it's a lot more subjective and more difficult to discern. As to the interchangeability question, you know, I'm going to put on a pharmacist hat. I would think this has more to do with an easier process with writing a prescription from a rheumatologist's perspective. They could write a prescription for brand Humira, for example, and the pharmacist could use any of the interchangeable products to fill that prescription, provided it's covered by the insurance company. So what this does is this eliminates phone calls or any kind of follow-up communications with the provider to obtain a prescription for a different product, which that could actually delay the process. And as I mentioned earlier, up until now, no products have been given interchangeable approval. So each order for a biosimilar or a brand had to be written for that particular product. Of course, this still won't help, you know, if payers want to use a product that doesn't have interchangeability, because they'll still have to write for that particular biosimilar. But those are the two things that I think are going to be in play here when we're talking about why there's been such a slow uptake, and then also, you know, what role does interchangeability play?
What are some ways health systems can instill confidence in biosimilar agents for RA among rheumatologists?
Continue to educate on the FDA's process for approving biosimilars. This is just a key, I think, to instilling confidence among the rheumatologists. Also, over the course of time, I've experienced a great deal of misunderstanding among providers about FDA-approved indications and how those actually relate to safety or efficacy. Labeling of a product, the package insert, the labeling is much more connected to existing patent limitations from the reference manufacturer and not so much related to clinical safety or efficacy use issues. Once a manufacturer gains biosimilar approval, then in the eyes of the FDA, you know, they can use those products for indications that have already been proven by the reference product. But because of the patent restrictions, that's what prohibits a lot of those indications from being used by the biosimilars. And the other thing here is, if the providers were given the right educational resources to pass along to their patients, it might help eliminate the potential of that nocebo effect that I mentioned earlier. There's really some good resources on the FDA's website in the biosimilar section around education, patient education, and they could even go to those and print some of those off to have in the office. It's also good to have FAQs available to answer a lot of those questions for the patient. So I think the biggest thing is making the providers just aware and keep pounding on that whole FDA approval process, and then making sure that they're able to educate their patients around the biosimilars as well.
What is the current status of biomarker tests to determine appropriate treatment options for RA, and how do biosimilars fit into these assessments?
Well, currently we have two diagnostic markers for rheumatoid arthritis. We have the rheumatoid factor, known as RF, and then we have the anti-CCP2, which is the anti-cyclic citrullinated peptide. And the anti-CCP2 is actually more sensitive and would pick up the disease when a rheumatoid factor may not necessarily show it. We also have ESD, which is also known as CEDRate, and then the C-reactive protein, or CRP test, that can help monitor disease progression and determine if a patient is benefiting from the treatment. None of these tests would influence or preclude a biosimilar from being utilized. Like, say, for instance, you would see in the oncology world, for instance, if you have a cancer patient that has to test HER2 positive before they can receive Herceptin or one of its biosimilars. In this case, the rheumatologist is basically just interested in reducing the inflammatory process overall with whatever works, whether that's TNF inhibitors like Humira or infliximab or any of those products, or even DMARDs. They're basically just interested in making sure that that C-reactive protein or CEDRate is showing that the treatment is actually working or something needs to be changed.
Although biosimilars are promised to provide significant savings, incentives for providers and payers, such as reimbursements and rebates, can prevent those savings from reaching patients. What needs to be done to address patient challenges related to the affordability and accessibility of RA biosimilars?
Well, when we're talking about this space and the adalimumab biosimilars, I think the biggest concern is just the discussion around copay accumulators. Insurers that are having these plans in place with these types of accumulators, you know, they don't count these co-payment cards toward a patient's deductible. And so obviously these types of plans really increase the deductibles substantially and really negate any benefit that's gained from the copay cards. So, you know, I think it's important that those things are addressed when we're talking about increased patient cost. Also, it's becoming common knowledge in the provider world about the use of rebates that are offered to PBMs and the fact that none of these savings ever reach the patient. Currently, you know, the patient responsibility doesn't benefit from any rebates or discounts. It's all based on list price. So there's been some analysis done by government to look at the impact of actually sharing these rebates at the point of sale, which you would think would make sense. But the finding was that, yeah, it could lower the cost of the drug, but it might also inadvertently increase premiums for plans like those patients that are on Medicare Part D plans. So they continue to debate and discuss these. I also think most recently, President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act that was looking at reducing out-of-pocket spending by, you know, capping those, I think that would potentially help as far as controlling the cost to the patients. We'll probably continue to see this get more and more attention as the biosimilars and other new biologics enter the market. Obviously, the price of these products are not cheap, and they continue to drive the healthcare costs higher and higher.
And lastly, do you have any concluding thoughts?
I remember when generics first entered the market. You know, there were hopes that those products would drive down cost and increase affordability without impacting safety or efficacy. At that time, there was lots of misinformation being circulated, some actually by the manufacturer of the brand drugs. There was lots of concern with their use from both the patients and the providers. And in those days, patients would advocate for the brand in spite of many states requiring the generic be dispensed unless there was a reason not to. We had insurance companies that were saying, you know, you had to use the generic. If you wanted the brand, then you'd have to pay extra. And many patients did. This age of biosimilars that we're in now, I think, is very similar. We're dealing with those same questions and concerns, and we're being mandated to use the biosimilars over the reference. But, you know, time and experience has a way of reducing fears and uncertainty, and I'm pretty confident that that's going to be the case with the biosimilars. The more we use them and we become comfortable with their effectiveness, I think the sooner they'll become just another more acceptable cost-effective treatment.
Well, Robert, thank you for sharing your insights with us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information on everything we discussed today in the show notes. And until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.